League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Welcome back to another exciting episode of On the Record with the two Mikes.
Indeed.
I'm Mike Graham. He's Mike Porky Parry.
Yep.
And of course, one of the things that we do on this particular series is we do a bit of Porky Vision.
We do.
Which people very much like. People really enjoy the last one, by the way.
Yep.
We do a little bit of Ask Porky.
That's right.
Which I think we've already done for this month. So
yes, we
will
have,
do another one in February.
Yep.
But we also do, of course, the Porky Review of Books.
Well, I brought some books along today.
Uh-huh.
Slam those down on
the
table.
Try not to make too much noise.
Yeah, sorry, but they're the ones that I get sent, and I have a look at them, right.
Yeah.
Now, one that caught my eye, and which I found highly entertaining but somewhat disturbing, is the latest biography, and there have been quite a few of them, of Tommy Cooper.
Oh, yes.
Okay?
Very funny man.
Did you see the TV programme on him about two or three years ago, or three or four years ago?
I don't know,
you know, it showed him to be vulnerable, to say the least, right? But although everybody loved him on stage and all that kind of stuff, he actually had a lot of problems in his life. To start off with, he cheated on his wife incessantly.
Did he?
A load of mistresses, yeah.
He doesn't look that sort of guy, does he?
Well, you know, how can you tell?
Well, I don't know how you can tell, actually. It's a very good point. But he didn't come across as a bloke who was particularly a ladies' man.
Yeah, well...
He was a kind of awkward character,
wasn't
he?
But, I mean, you see, a lot of them are dark horses, if you see what I mean.
Very true.
Secondly, he became an alcoholic, chronic alcoholic. Mm. And, you know, you've heard this this expression lots of times, and you and I have said something, you know, which is outrageous, or very funny, or something like that.
Yeah.
And you get all these messages saying, hey, Porky... You know, less sherry on your cornflakes and all that.
Right.
Well, Tommy Cooper literally used to drink bowls of cornflakes and gin.
No.
Yes, he used to lace his cornflakes
with gin. Did he put milk in as well?
No. No.
Really?
He just put the cornflake. He said, you know, I've got to get some lining in my stomach. He'd get the box out, shake out a bowl of cornflakes, and then pour gin all over them and eat that for breakfast. He was...
That takes some doing, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because you know what I did the other night?
Yes.
I decided, bad idea. I woke up in the middle of the night and I thought, I don't want to have a glass of wine because I've got to get up in the morning.
Yes.
And that's a bad thing.
Yes.
So I decided to take a couple of shots of brandy.
Yeah.
Right, cognac.
Yeah. When was this?
This is the other night, a few months ago.
Yeah. Well, you felt ill?
No, I just woke up.
Right.
And it was about 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And I thought, maybe I'll need some help going back to sleep.
Right, okay.
So I decided...
I don't think alcohol helps you go to sleep.
I don't think it does either.
No.
So it was still 3 o'clock and I was still awake.
Right.
And I'd been awake for an hour.
Yeah, exactly.
And I had about four shots of brandy.
Yes.
So it wasn't a very good
idea. No, it wasn't a very good
idea. So I'm not going to do that again.
In fact, funny enough, I was talking to one of our colleagues, a former professional footballer.
Oh, yeah.
When I saw him for a drink last week, he said he woke up at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock and 4 o'clock.
Oh, God.
The night before he came in to do a breakfast show with Alan Brazil.
Oh, yeah.
And this was all in the Novotel, you know, in Farringdon Road.
Oh, yeah.
And then he'd sleep for 10 minutes and then wake up again.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, you can't...
I think it's a function of age, isn't it?
Well, it might be, but remember that that newsreader for ITN, Tom, whatever his name is.
Oh, yeah.
Tom Bradby.
That's it.
Is that his name?
The former Royal Correspondent.
Former Royal Correspondent.
He was the guy that blew the gaff on the News of the World, wasn't he?
Blew the gaff on the News of the World. He didn't.
Because he was the one that had left the message.
He left the message about a knee, right?
Mm.
He left a message saying to William, sorry to hear about your knee injury.
Right.
That message was intercepted by somebody on News of the World.
Clive Goodman,
the Royal Correspondent, who then wrote a story about it. And they worked backwards and found out that the only people who'd ever spoken about it were William and Tom Bradby, but they hadn't actually spoken to each other about it, so it must have been the intercepted message.
Yes.
That's how they found it.
Yeah.
But no, what I was going to say was he was off for 3 months with total insomnia.
Yeah.
He couldn't sleep.
He couldn't sleep at all.
Couldn't sleep.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Tommy Cooper, right?
Yeah.
He, first of all, he was a complete loner. He once said, "I've never had a friend and I don't want a friend. You know, I work in isolation."
Right.
And what he would do is he would try out all his crap jokes on people in the street just by walking up to them and saying things like, "Have you seen my mate? He's the one who got run over by a brewery wagon.
Right.
First time the drink's ever been on him."
See, I love Tommy Cooper's jokes. There's actually, as we're speaking,
yeah.
I'm going to see if I can find, there's a Tommy Cooper Twitter account, which all it actually does
is repeat Tommy Cooper jokes.
Just repeat Tommy Cooper jokes. Like, for example, my favourite one of the guy where he goes, bloke goes to the doctor and he says, "Doctor," he said, "I'm very, very upset." He said, "What's wrong with you?" He said, "I feel like I'm a pair of curtains."
Mm.
The doctor says, "Pull yourself together."
That's right, yeah. Well, my favourite one was Tommy Cooper standing there with his fez hat on saying, "A man walks into a bar. He went, ouch, it was a 9 bar.
It's great. I've got it here, look. Electricity is a wonderful thing. Do you realise that if we didn't have electricity, we'd be watching television by candlelight?
Absolutely, yeah. And there's another one here. He says, he goes to the doctor again. He says, "Doctor, I think I'm a dog." And the doctor said, "Climb up on my couch." He said, "I'm not allowed to." And then he said, on stage, he said, "I cleaned out the attic. Cleaned out the attic with the wife the other day. Damp, filthy, full of cobwebs, but she's okay with the kids." You know, and like jokes like that and all that.
Here's one. I said, "How long will my spaghetti be?" The waiter said, "I don't know. We never measure it."
Absolutely. He donned the fez in Egypt when he was on national service during the Second World War, sent overseas in 1943, wounded in the Western Desert, and sent back to Cairo to the hospital, where, because of his invalidity, he volunteered to perform for military concert parties.
All right.
In Egypt, he first donned a fez. Everybody said how exotic it looked, so he took it over to England. That became his,
his trademark.
His trademark.
It?
Yeah.
Was it not the case that Alan Brazil was in the audience when he expired on stage
at the London Palladium, and it was a charity do? I was watching it. The curtain closed. Tommy Cooper's feet slipped out from under the curtain. And
well,
of course,
did he not collapse before the curtain closed?
No.
Oh, right.
No.
I thought he collapsed before the curtain closed.
The way Al told it to me was the curtain was closing and then Tommy Cooper's feet suddenly poked out underneath the curtain.
All right.
And everybody knew it was his feet because he had huge feet. You know, he's a big bloke, 6'4". And of course, everybody's laughing and all of a sudden the feet disappeared again. And the bloke came on and said, "I'm sorry, due to an illness amongst the cast, we're going to have to postpone tonight's performance.
So
I'm very sorry."
So they didn't actually tell the audience he'd died at that point?
Well, I hadn't even met a doctor there to confirm he was dead.
Bloody hell.
Yeah. He was 6'4" and wore size 13 shoes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the new book is about his kind of personal life, isn't it?
Yeah, it's about his personal life and his complicated personal life.
Yeah. How many times was he married then? Was he married a lot or did he have one of these long-suffering wives?
Well, he had a long-suffering wife called Miff.
Miff,
M-I-F-F. I don't know what her real name was.
That's a strange name.
Yeah, it is, yeah. But anyway, she had sole control managing Tommy's bookings and fees, built Tommy up, positioning him in cabarets and clubs and on the theatre events, pantomimes, summer seasons, working with Benny Hill and Morecambe and Wise, okay? And sorted out travel arrangements because he couldn't do anything himself. You know, he needed somebody who could do it. By the 50s, Tommy was earning $10,000 a year, a huge sum in those
days. That was
a
lot of money, yeah.
Yeah. And
I remember that because my dad told me when he first came to work in London, which would have been about 1955-ish, that he was making £1,000 a year,
which was
considered quite a decent wage.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
So $10,000 is great.
Absolutely. But as soon as television opened up, he was soon earning $10,000 a week.
Blimey.
Or certainly not in the 50s, but in the early 60s.
Right.
Unfortunately, Tommy resented having to pay his 15% commission, and he very rarely paid either his agents or even his gag writers.
But that's $500,000 a year in those days.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money, isn't it?
Yeah. Indeed, Tommy felt hard done by if he was ever asked to part with money. He never paid the gag writers if he could manage it, and he never paid for tricks acquired from London's magic emporiums, where the done thing was to, you know, buy, you know, like you and I would buy stories as journalists. Yeah, yeah. You could buy, magician's tricks.
Okay.
But he said, well, I'm Tommy Cooper, so, you know, I don't have to pay.
But also, he was very adept, he not, at doing an act which didn't really involve doing very much, because most of the tricks that he did didn't work.
No, that's right. They were supposed not to work.
And that was supposed to
be
the
funny. But apparently you have to be very brilliant to make them not work, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, he never once bought a round of drinks that anybody can remember. Mm. He used to go into pubs with his friends and say, you get the teas and I'll get the chairs. He'd say, have a drink on me. He told a taxi driver and then put into his hand a tea bag.
Mm.
That was one of his jokes.
Yeah, that was his tip.
Yeah, he walked around with loads of tea bags in his pockets, right. and he'd say to the cab driver, he'd put his hand out, you know, have a drink on me, son, and give him a tea bag.
That's quite funny. Actually.
Somebody told me once when they saw Tommy Cooper in a restaurant, he was sitting at the table and the person approached him and said, hello, Mr. Cooper, I'm really sorry. Yeah. I just wanted to come over and say this. I said, yeah, that's fine, don't worry about that. That's all, that's fine. And can I have your autograph? Yeah, you can have that, fine. That's no problem at all.
Yeah.
And Tommy Cooper then picked up a load of ice cubes, sugar cubes, from the bowl in the middle of the table and crushed them all over the floor and said to the bloke who'd gone over to say hello, what's that then?
Yeah.
And the guy said, I don't know. He said, an Eskimo having a piss, you know? And he was just full of jokes all the time, apparently.
Yeah.
I
thought you were going to say he then asked the guy for some money for taking his picture.
No. Tommy eventually married a woman called Gwen Henty in 1947.
Mm.
Relationship characterised by bad temper and sentimental reconciliations. None of their furniture was ever in one piece because they often threw it at each other and it would break against the walls and... they both had a severe drink problem.
Sounds like it.
Tommy drank to eradicate stage fright.
Mm-hmm.
That's a new one. We'll have to try that.
Well, drink...
Do we drink to eradicate stage fright?
I'm not sure why we drink. I think we drink just because we drink, I think, bottom line. Yes. I mean, I've...
But when we do a live show,
I've never had that. Have you?
What?
Stage fright.
Not really.
I mean, I think the first time I was a bit nervous, I would say,
was
when we did that first big show in Birmingham.
Yes, okay,
because we'd gone from doing the Hen and Chickens, was very intimate.
52 people.
But also, you were right in front of them.
Yeah, you were.
So you couldn't afford to be shy, really.
No, that's right.
Because you're literally two feet away from you.
Yeah.
But when I saw that theatre first, I remember I went to look at it.
Yeah.
And it was, I mean, by now our standard's quite small, 300.
Yes, that's right.
Massive.
It did look massive.
And I thought, I remember looking out and seeing the crowd there, and I thought, blimey, that was the one and only time, really, that I felt a bit nervous.
Well, I think that's maybe why we did take a drink. Yeah.
This year when we did the show at Sheffield's Empire, which I'm hoping we're going to do again this year.
Yes.
I actually was a bit more careful about not getting quite so pissed as I got the year before.
Well, maybe,
because I had some lunch. Right?
Yeah.
I remember to eat, had a hamburger.
Yeah.
And I actually was quite sober when we started the show.
Yes.
I wasn't so sober by the end of it.
Yeah, well, neither of us are, because part of the reason the audience come is to get involved in what we call bladderation.
Yes, indeed.
But anyway, just to read this on, Tommy drank to eradicate stage fright, and he was up till 5 every morning...
Mm.
Getting through bottles of scotch.
Yeah, but hang on a second, right? This is a great ruse, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because if somebody comes up to you and goes, Porky, why are you having a bottle of whiskey at 5 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah.
And you go, oh, it's all right. Yeah. I'm suffering from stage fright.
Yeah, that's right.
Hang on, you're not going to the fucking stage until next month.
Yeah, that's right. You've got to practice.
You're not going on the fucking stage.
That's
why is he drinking?
But also, right, on the scotch. The tale about gin on cornflakes is absolutely true. He poured gin on his cornflakes after he told, with a straight face, everybody who asked him, that full fat milk was unhealthy.
Oh, yeah.
Because
so he didn't put milk on them at all?
No. It could clog up your veins, okay?
Blimey.
Right. Without a shadow of a doubt, he descended into chronic alcoholism.
Yeah.
That led to sciatica, right?
Yeah.
Which, of course,
that's what you've got. Yeah.
That's right,
Maybe it's the two things are connected.
No, it's not from drink.
Maybe it is.
No, I don't think it is.
Well, what's yours from?
Well, my sciatica is from the fact that after suffering years and years of heart debilitation disease, it gets to your joints, you know, because you've got to hold your body up when it's not strong enough to and all that kind of stuff.
Well, so if you weren't so heavy, then you wouldn't have such a problem.
No, you don't understand, and I'm not going to spend time trying to explain to you.
Okay.
Here we go. He also smoked 40 cigars a day.
Bloody hell.
Right. Now,
did he have a heart attack when he
yeah,
died?
Yeah, that's what he died of, The combination of chronic alcoholism and smoking 40 cigars a day resulted in terrible varicose veins problems, bronchial and cardiac disease.
Yes.
It was absolutely no mystery to anybody when he eventually collapsed. But he conducted a 17-year-long affair with another woman, who was his dresser. And the relationship was common knowledge in the business, but his wife, Gwen, pretended to know nothing about it, okay?
Right.
Mary was with Tommy when he died on April the 15th, 1984, during a live LWT broadcast in a theatre.
God, I didn't know it was that long ago.
Yeah, I didn't either. I mean, golly, that 1984, blimey.
84, that's the year I went to America.
It's the year you went to America, and it's the year that I became news editor of the Daily Express.
Well, I remember it happening.
Yeah.
You know?
No, hang on, I'm going mad. 1984 was the... I was in America. I came to America,
but
yeah.
You came back in 84 as well.
Yeah, I did,
You gone in 83, didn't you?
No, 82, actually. 82 came back. I came back in 85,
May have been made news editor by the end of 84.
That's right, maybe, yeah. But he donned a cloak, fell backwards, and the size 13 shoes stuck out from beneath the curtains.
Right.
It was after the curtains had been drawn.
Right.
The audience found it incredibly funny, thought it was all part of the act.
Right.
The only way that they knew he was absolutely stone cold dead was because he had not touched the packet of banana sandwiches that his wife had provided for him on the side of the show, which was the only food he ever ate. And he'd said before the show he hadn't felt too well and he didn't want the sandwiches, which led people to think that, you know, there was something odd. Anyway, he keeled over and died.
So what's the name of the book?
The book is called let me see, Cooperman, The Life of Tommy Cooper.
Cooperman.
By Ian Carroll.
Okay.
Yeah. But so, I mean, it's a really tragic story.
Fan of Tommy Cooper, that's worth reading.
Indeed.
Indeed. This is the Porky Review of Books. We are the two mics.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Now, it's always interesting reading your book or hearing your review of books. We call it the review of books because that's what the New York Times calls their book review section.
That's right,
calling it book review.
Yeah.
You call it review of books. It sounds posher, doesn't it?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So what else you got?
Well, listen, there's a book here about people that I like, and this guy is actually the richest man in the world. This guy is called Mr. 5%. That's the name of the book, okay? And it's The Many Lives of Kallust Gulbenkian, the world's richest man. He was the world's richest man just before Rockefeller.
Oh, yeah.
At the beginning of the 1920s, Kallust Gulbenkian was one of the richest and most influential men on the planet as the driving force behind the Turkish Petroleum Company, a consortium with exclusive rights to all oil in the New Kingdom of Iraq.
Hmm.
The Ottoman-born Armenian businessman struck Western observers as a fascinatingly exotic figure, like one of the all-powerful financiers in an early Agatha Christie thriller. To the Daily Express, who reported on him avidly, Gulbenkian was a man of mystery, a great inscrutable figure, but to the newspaper's Sunday stablemate, he was one... That was the Sunday Express.
Yeah.
He was one of the few men whose reputation is questioned all over the world.
Mm.
Best known for his magnificent art collection, which even today is now housed in the Gulbenkian Art Museum, bears his name, in London.
All right.
Oh, no, it's not. In Lisbon.
I was going to say, Gulbenkian. I haven't heard of that one.
Yeah, yeah, that's right, yeah. He was the old world's answer to business, thrusting business tycoons such as Andrew Carnegie.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, the Carnegie Hall in New York
famously
is named after him. Yeah.
Well, Andrew Carnegie is a massively well-known figure, isn't he?
Yes.
And not only did he do the Carnegie Hall,
because
that was part of his philanthropy.
That's right, yeah.
But he also, did he not also do like Carnegie Mellon University? And there's all sorts of things in Pittsburgh, I think, which have got something to do with
Well, Pittsburgh is right, because, of course, what he did was he invented a way of producing steel at one-tenth of the cost it was being produced in those days.
Right.
He invented
furnace. Like a foundry or something.
Yeah, some furnace or to blow like air and oxygen into the process or something like that.
Yes.
You know, he made it much cheaper, and then he had a monopoly on the sale of steel all over America, if not the world, okay?
Yes.
But this guy had terrible extravagances, okay? His pet canaries...
Appetites, do you mean?
Yes, yes. His pecuniaries only drank Evian water.
What?
We're only allowed to drink Evian water.
That's ridiculous.
Which in those days was 100 times more expensive than it is now.
I'm not
because
surprised.
It wasn't it wasn't sold in corner shops.
Right.
You had to have it imported from
Evian.
I'm amazed.
Is Evian in France? I think it is.
Yeah.
I was amazed you could even get such a thing.
Yeah. No.
Like mineral water in those days. Do you remember the first time you had mineral water?
Not really.
I think I had it.
It would have been bubbly stuff, I suppose.
I think if I first had it in somewhere like Italy.
Yeah.
And it would have been that Pellegrino stuff.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know where it was. You know they still serve it to you now, but you know. It's
I know the Pellegrino.
Sparkling water.
Yeah, it probably was abroad because they started bottling it abroad a bit more because they haven't got any water, have they, in places like Spain?
Well, the thing certain is, times they've got of the it, year. But you don't want to drink the water. That's the thing.
I mean,
because it's not very clean.
Yeah, sure.
And you might get you know.
Sure. Now another one of Mr. Moneybags' excesses. At his peak in the 1920s, he completely renovated a splendid Parisian mansion in which visitors ascended through halls of Rodin sculptures, Lalique glassware, and Edward Burne-Jones paintings to his suite at the top. Yet he rarely slept there. He preferred to spend his evenings in another personal suite which he took at the Ritz Hotel. He could dine and bed the parade of young women.
Is this in London?
No, this is in Paris.
Oh, in Paris, right.
At the Ritz Hotel, he could dine and bed the parade of young women who were discreetly provided for his pleasure by the manager of the hotel.
Very nice.
Gulbenkian's inner life remains a mystery. During the Armenian massacre of the mid-1910s, I'm not interested in that.
why not?
Well, you know, nobody's ever heard of it.
People being slaughtered.
Well, I know, it's unfortunate.
I mean, I think I've heard of the Armenian massacre.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Yeah, but he did have a conscience about the Armenian massacre because when he was asked to make a small donation towards a new Armenian church near Kensington High Street, he actually built it himself with his own money.
I think I know where that is. I think I know the Armenian church is in Kensington High Street.
Okay. Mr. 5% trades heavily on Gulbenkian's reputation. This is the name, Mr. 5%, came from his reputation as the world's richest man. When he died in Lisbon in 1955, where he'd settled during the Second World War, his fortune was worth some £5 billion in today's money. Mm. But in 1955, they didn't have Bill Gates, and they didn't have Amazon, and they didn't have Jeff Bezos.
Right.
They just had industrialists, and he was the richest industrialist. He was even richer than Henry Ford.
Or the Gettys or anything.
And
like
the Gettys
that.
And all that,
Well, that's why I think he got into the banking business, because as much as you're right to say that he was an industrialist and he was involved in all kinds of things like the steel industry and maybe, I think railways maybe as well.
Right.
But a lot of it then became banking.
Yeah.
You know, like the Mellon family.
Yeah, sure.
Got into banking.
Yeah, sure.
And I think Carnegie did as well.
Mm. And another thing to tell you is that, again, he was friendless. You know, I said like Tommy Cooper was friendless.
Oh, yeah.
He was friendless.
Well, a bit like you then.
A bit like me, I suppose, yeah. But I mean, a lot of good people are.
Perhaps he's like you, he believed that, you know, friends are a nuisance.
It could be. Could be. So all the women that he ever romanced were, you know, like women of the night, so to speak. And you
prostitutes?
Know, not really prostitutes. I would say much higher class than that.
What then?
Well, sometimes the wives of friends.
Okay.
And sometimes, you know, women who were just seeking, you know, a bit of reflected glory from being rogerized by the richest man in the world. You know what I mean?
Well, I suppose he probably gave him some nice gifts.
Yeah, well, I suppose he did. But when he died, his memorial service was held in the Armenian church he'd built.
Okay.
It was so thinly attended that the Daily Express, who'd been a big supporter of his all his life, didn't carry a report on it because they were too embarrassed to print the fact that there were only two mourners.
Really?
Yeah, two mourners. And he was the richest man in the world.
That's a shame.
Isn't that amazing?
That is a shame.
What an end to come to.
How many people do you think will be at your funeral?
I should imagine I'll have to close the street.
I think there'll be quite a few people at your funeral.
Yeah, of course there will. I've been really nice and kind to people all my life.
No, there'll be people. There'll be several sets of people at your funeral. There'll be members of your family. Right?
Yes.
There'll be people that like you, revere you, think of you as a very talented individual.
Absolutely.
But there will also be those who want to make sure you're dead.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
What do you mean, dead?
Well, there'll be people who want to make sure you're dead.
You're rubbish.
You know, they'll
I've never done
up.
Anybody any harm.
You must be joking.
No, I haven't.
Well, what about Jim Watson?
Oh, well, Jim Watson was a dickhead.
I hated you then, and I hate you now. Yeah. But, I mean, there's a lot of people like him.
Yeah, but he was a lazy dickhead.
Yeah, but that's not the point.
Well,
you just said you never did anybody any harm.
Yeah.
You fired people.
I tell you what, it was interesting. Jim Watson and Brian Cashinella appointed themselves before I became the news editor, under the old news editor, who was as weak as piss, you know, and spent all day in the pub. No, well, they all did. They had a rotor on the news desk, you know, right, you're in the pub from 10 till 12, this is in the morning,
right,
and you come back, then he goes out 12 till 2, right, and he comes back, and then you go out 2 till 4. Meanwhile, the news editor's in the pub all day long, you know, no problem.
Yeah, but you know what the problem was, though? Yeah. When you left, right, and I came back, and you went back to America, and I came back to London, and I started working as a reporter, they'd all been fucking cowed into complete and utter fear of going anywhere.
Right.
Because they all used to go down to the canteen.
Yeah.
And I remember the first couple of days I was there, and I noticed a couple of them sort of getting up, and Alex Hendry and fucking Fuller and all these guys, right? And I'm like, where you guys got to? Oh, we're just going down to the canteen.
Yeah.
I'm like, you're joking.
Yeah, but they never went up the pub anyway. They were dullards.
No, but they were they were not keen on going. They've more or less been cowed into not going out at all because of you.
No, not because of me at all. Yes. They were dullards.
In the same way that you banned smoking, apparently.
I did ban smoking, absolutely right. They were disgusting habits.
Well, I started again when I got there.
Yeah, I know, I heard that, yeah. No, what was I going to say? What were we talking about there?
We were talking about your funeral.
Nobody
would turn up who didn't like you.
No,
there'd be never upset
anybody. On the old Jim Watson one, that's right, him and Cascinello with the copy tasters, which was the world's easiest job, because there were no computers in those days. Yeah. So Roger the Messenger, who we had to employ, he had a bit of a twitch, and I'm not being unkind, but the problem with...
Well, the problem with Roger was he'd fallen down a lift shaft.
He'd fallen down the lift shaft, because when he pressed the button and the lift doors opened, there was no fucking lift there, and Roger stepped in it. This was before he had his twitch.
That's right.
But he had his twitch evermore after that.
Well, he was then apparently offered a job for life.
Yeah, that's right.
Because the Express have shat themselves.
Yeah,
because they thought, we can't pay this guy off.
They're paying millions, you know, because it was such a bad deal not to have a lift in a lift shaft. And
the story about Roger was still that one on his birthday.
What was that?
Remember? No. When he got completely rat-arsed because everyone took him down to the pub in the... And this was in the new building.
Yeah, I see.
Took him down to the pub on the Popinjay on the first floor.
Yeah.
Out the ground floor, whatever. And he got completely rat-arsed, right? And he came back upstairs to do the shift in the afternoon.
Yes.
But he was too pissed to do anything.
He didn't fall down a lift shaft again.
No, nobody would give him anything to do, but he was just sitting there. He used to sit sort of next to the news.
And loll. He just used to loll
And somebody I can't remember if it was Heseltine or somebody came to see Nick Lloyd.
Right, yeah.
Some fucking cabinet minister.
Yeah.
And Nick did that thing where he's showing around. This is the back bench. This is where they decide on where all the stories go.
Yeah. These are the guys who rip out your reputation, Mr. Heseltine.
And then as they got closer to Roger the Messenger, he literally sort of sat bolt upright and hurled into the bin because he was so pissed.
Oh,
I just threw up into the bin right in front of whoever the guy, you know, whoever
should've
the cabinet.
Him. That would have been a good excuse.
Nick just took one look and just looked at the Duke because he thought the Duke's got him that pissed.
That's
He says, get rid of that man.
Yeah.
And they're just trying to hoist him out of the fucking building.
Get him out,
hilarious.
Yeah. But so these two guys appointed themselves copy tasters. Roger would bring the copy round, and then all he had to do was read it, right, and then put it in another basket. Didn't even pass an opinion on it.
No, you know, they just had to make sure that you could see it.
Yeah, that's right.
And then in case they got into trouble, they go, no, I gave it to you.
Yeah, and they pass everything over. Yeah. I said, look, the job of a copy taster is just to give me the good stories. I don't want all the rubbish.
Yeah.
You want this? Well, you know, we don't know what you like and what we don't. I said, well, it's a judgment on whether it's a good story
or not. That fat roly-poly guy used to sit next to Terry Manners. He was the copy taster on the back bench. He was the guy who I took his job over.
There were a few people
like that. He had, when he told me, and by that stage they'd got the new computer system in, right?
Yes.
Not the QPS one, but the old one.
Yes.
The old ATEX one.
Yes.
And they had all these, you know, electronic baskets for the news stories.
Yes.
And I said, what's that one there? He said, oh, that's Possibles. I said, what's that?
Mm.
He said, well, those are stories I'm not sure about.
Yeah.
I went, what do you mean you're not fucking sure about them?
Be sure.
He said, well, you know, if somebody else has got that one, I haven't given it to Terry, then I go in there and I get it and I give it to him.
Mm.
I said, well, why wouldn't you give it to him first of all?
Yeah.
Well, because I'm not sure if he'd want it.
Yeah.
And the bloke was a complete fucking moron.
Complete idiot.
You know.
What was his name? Bingo.
No, Bingo was the chief sub.
Bingo
was good. That was Bingo. No, Bingo was the chief sub.
Right, okay.
He was actually good.
Okay, yeah.
Now, this guy used to sit on the back bench. He was fat, sort of ginger curly hair.
No, I don't remember him.
His main job basically was to go down to the fucking bar every half an hour and fill up a paper cup full of wine.
And bring it back for
Terry. Bring it back for Terry Manners.
I brought back a bottle of very strong vodka from Russia once when I'd been out there to see Peter Hitchens, you know, on a fact-finding mission, you know, who was our correspondent there. And I had a little office at the top of top of the newsroom there, you know, which Terry coveted because he was the night editor, but it was my office, you know. And so
did you share it?
No, because I wouldn't have him in my office, you know. Terry was a prick. He was a
highly of you.
Yeah, a jumped up little, you know, tosser who wanted, you know, respect in life. And, you know, I'm the night editor. Right. I have a senior position to you. Oh, why is that then, Terry? Because I get the paper out every night. I said, you get the paper out, mate, because I give you the fucking stories to put in it, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, I thought as a peace gesture, and I came back, I brought this bottle of banana vodka back. And I said, oh, tell, come and have a word. You know, a couple of things I need to talk to you about following my trip to, Moscow. He said, oh, okay. So Terry came up and I said, yeah, I'll have a try a glass of this. Anyway, consequently, Terry, man has got completely off his head, you know, because what happened was...
He got quite noisy when he was pissed, didn't he?
He'd wave his arms around and he'd make terrible judgments on stories. Right. Nick would wonder why the next morning we'd suddenly splashed on, you know, an oak tree falling over at Buckingham Palace or something like this, you know what I mean?
Right.
Instead of a policeman who'd been shot six times in the mall or something like that, you know. And it was because Terry was off his face. But what he did that afternoon was he had a couple of glasses with me and we were drinking it in those small, like, sherry-type glasses that you drink vodka in, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'd brought a couple of them back as well. And then, unbeknown to me, I went back and got on with my job. Terry was slipping in and out of my office all afternoon because when
Sipping on the vodka?
He was opening the fridge. There was a fridge in there, and he was swigging the vodka. Because when I got back in at 6:30 or 7, I was going to offer Nick and Paul Potts a glass of my banana vodka.
Oh, yeah.
There was none left.
Oh, dear.
It had all gone. And Terry had disappeared.
Right.
Terry was in the bar downstairs. I mean, it was a terrible drinking culture, really. Terrible. But anyway, getting back to Cashinella.
Matters at hand, yes.
And Jimmy Watson, yeah. I said, look, the two of you just sit there and you just read the same bit of paper and then pass it to me. I said, you know, one of you doesn't even need to be doing that. Never mind two.
Yeah.
So you are appointed as regional news editor. And this look of horror in their eyes, you know.
Yeah.
What do you mean? I said, well, I deal with everything that happens here in London.
Yeah.
And
national stories.
National stories. I look at the foreign desk because I know more about it than that idiot David Richardson sitting over there.
Because
he's never been abroad. Yeah. He'd never been to America when he was made foreign editor.
No, no.
Never literally been to America. Yeah. I said, and I have to keep my eye on, you know, commercial matters which infringe upon the news operation.
Yeah.
I said, so you're going to deal with all the correspondents in Birmingham and Newcastle, Manchester, Liverpool, West Country, do you understand?
Right.
Well, what you mean, I just taste their copy? I said, no, you fucking speak to them every morning. What? All of them?
Yeah, fucking list.
I said, yeah. And then you bring them to me and you tell me what story we've got from the provinces that day. Well, that could take ages. I said, yeah, it would take ages if you do it properly.
Right.
I said, if you organise it properly, you get them to fucking ring you and tell you what they've got that day.
Mm.
I said, and by the way, the most important day that needs to be done is Sunday.
Mm.
And they went, I nearly fainted. Because these were 9 to 5 men, Monday to Friday. Yeah.
Well, when I took over the back bench, right, one of the reasons I did it was because there was a bloke called Andy Gregory.
I remember him. Northern lad.
He's gone off to the Mail. Bolton Boy, we used to call
Bolton
him.
Bolton Boy.
Bolton, he was from.
Bolton.
And this other guy called, what was his name? Dave Harbord.
Right.
Right, who were the two kind of night editors.
Yes.
Right? But they'd somehow worked it so that they only worked 3 days a week.
3 days a week,
You know, 3 days on, sort of fucking 4 days off, and then they'd come back and do another three.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
And I said, well, this is bullshit. I said, I don't mind a 4 day week, but you can't do a bloody 3 day week. Yeah. You're fucking joking.
Absolutely right.
Absolutely unbelievable.
Now, that brings us to.
So, what book was that then we were talking about?
That was the World's Richest Man.
Time for one more.
Yeah, time for one more. So that brings me, I'm leading up to this, that brings me to a book I've got here.
Yeah.
Have a look at it. It's called Lab Rats, okay?
Oh, yeah.
And what this is all about is the way that your working environment can drive you mad.
Yes, I can understand that.
Because if you look at this picture here, this is a typical office these days. People are boxed off in little cubicles, right?
Yeah.
And it's called Lab Rats because you actually react to things like, you know, the ticking of the clock and all this kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
Right.
And it's driving
me. Well, there's a lot of call centres that are like that. You know, a lot of call centres are like that.
And a lot of call centres are like that.
Put your hand up if you want to go to the toilet.
Yeah, that's right. And all
you basically spend all day ringing people.
Yes.
All you do is ring people.
That's right.
That's it.
That's right.
You know.
Now he said that the reason that employers can get away with this is because of the deep job insecurity which has started in America and spread around the world.
Yes.
It's in America, of course, you don't get any payoff or anything. You get a pink slip and 2 weeks' money, don't you?
I mean, it's very, very much less well looked after than we are here.
Yeah.
I mean, I was reading the other day, right, and I'm not wishing to get into a whole conversation about universal credit, but 7 million people in this country are in receipt of some form of benefit.
I know.
7 million.
Unbelievable.
You know, now in America,
yeah,
if you get fucking made unemployed,
yeah,
you're allowed to seek unemployment money, and you can get unemployment, yeah, as they call it,
yeah,
but you only get it for 6 months. And it's after six, yeah, months, you have to get a job.
Get yourself a job.
Doesn't
again
matter what kind of job you get.
Yeah.
But you don't get any more money from the state.
No, that's absolutely
and that's
right.
That's surely the way we should do it here.
You'd think so, yeah. Now, it says here, the argument that American workers are suffering from deep job-related insecurity is one great fear.
Right.
The author of this book is a guy called Dan Lyons. And what he writes in this chapter here I've got is, this passage here, he says, half of the people who now work in the Western world live each day with the gut-wrenching, depression-causing, anxiety-inducing fear, that they will either A, lose their job, or not be up to their job that day, or not be able to face going through the door of their workplace.
Is this happening in this country now? Is that,
yeah, it's happening in this country, really? As well, yeah.
Have you ever felt like that?
No, I've always wanted to go to work. Yeah. I've always wanted to go. I mean, look.
I mean, you and I probably have both had positions, though, where it's been difficult, hasn't it?
Yes. Oh,
Where you've had, not because of the work that you could do, but because of the work that some people are not letting you do.
Yes, that's
you
right.
You know what I mean? Like people fucking with you and people kind of, you know, playing politics.
Yes.
You've never been incapable of doing any job. However,
no,
people have sometimes been difficult to fucking manoeuvre yourself around.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
But I used to say when I was news at the Daily Express that every day, as I got to the door of the Black Lubyanka in Fleet Street, which is where I was first the news editor, and of course, that's an Art Deco building. It's a legendary building. It's built by Beaverbrook. I felt this sense of, I can't believe that it's actually me going through this door as a news editor. And I got a flutter in my stomach thinking something might happen today I can't handle.
Yeah.
But I do believe that without that sort of incentive in your working day, you're not going to be on your tiptoes. You
no,
know?
Of course.
You're not going to be doing it.
Oh, yeah. I totally agree. I mean, you can't be too comfortable.
Yes.
But by the same token, what I'm saying is that there is no job that you could never do.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely.
Mm.
So this is really a book all about the fact that, you know, working to many, many millions of people in this world is a misery. And I can tell you that, for instance, in the 60s, right, when I was brought up, my old fellow was a travelling salesman.
Yeah.
So he didn't particularly like his job. It was hard and arduous. He used to go out every day in his car. He used to have to find people who would buy the goods he was selling and all that.
Mm.
It wasn't, you know, it wasn't great. But a lot of my mates who went to the local comprehensive school, their fathers were of much lower intelligence than mine.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. And they worked.
No rat-like cunning.
They had no rat-like cunning. In fact, half of them didn't have any intelligence. Mm. They used to go to work, come out, go to the pub, smoke fags, drink beer, then go home and watch, you know, a bit of telly, but would never watch Panorama because they couldn't understand it.
Right.
They were just a bunch of thickos, you know. Yeah.
Well, their lives were simpler then as well.
Well, yeah, but you see, this is a good point. Because a lot of them worked in the car industry at either Vauxhall's in Ellesmere Port or Ford Halewood in Liverpool.
Right.
Now, that job in those days, they've tried to change it now because they realise it drives people mad. But it did actually involve pulling a lever every 40 seconds to place, you know, a badge or something on the side of a car.
Okay.
Or a light bulb.
Or a stamp of some kind.
Yeah, a stamp or press a light bulb into a car. Or
it
they might
be soul-destroying, that, wouldn't it?
Well, I was about to say, even if they had a more exciting job, it was basically just to drive a rivet gun that put a wheel onto the car passing on the production line.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
When the production lines first came out, nobody realised it was going to drive the workers mad through the monotony of the repetitive action they had to undertake, okay?
Yeah.
So they'd go on strike all the time.
Right.
Strikes normally happen, not because people were unhappy with the money or the conditions. They were just so bored out of their brains that they were being driven mad.
Yeah.
So they went on strike all the time, right?
Right.
I know these things. I studied sociology. And I found this out one time in a student break, you know, when I had a holiday.
Yeah.
You know, you could go and get a job. So I go up to this factory where I heard there may be some vacancies from, again, the father of one of my mates who was a numbskull, you know, said, hey, Mike, hey, tell you what. Yeah, won't believe it, Mike. Because all my other mates, I was 18, had all gone into work by then, you know, full-time work.
Yeah.
They'd left school at 16. They're all thickos as well, wanted to be footballers, you know. Yeah. So
all your mates were thickos?
Yeah, most of them, Most of them were, And he said, hey, Mike, you know, a couple of vacancies at our place, you know, you get up there and, you know, you always put a word in for you. And I said, no, don't put a word in for me, Norman. Yeah. This is the father of one of my mates. Because
yeah.
I thought, if he does, the manager will say, well, anybody he recommends must be another thickhead, you know. So I went to see this guy myself.
Yeah.
And the guy was so impressed because I was intelligent.
Yeah.
He said, I'd love to have you. Because these thickheads, they used to knacker the machines all the time, either deliberately.
Yeah.
Or because they... And also it had to do, this was the job, right, there was a machine press that where two huge pieces of metal came together. There was an infusion of plastic, and when they parted, there was a plastic lid for a sandwich box. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
Produce lids for sandwich boxes. Right. You know, what are they called?
Well, like
Pyrex or something. Pyrex. No, not Pyrex, no, plastic Pyrex. Glass. You know, plastic.
Yeah, I know.
Plastic, you know, plastic lunch boxes. Yeah. And for 8 hours...
Tupperware,
well done. For 8 hours, all you had to do was open the safety gate... Reach in, because the two bits of the machine couldn't come together when the safety gate was open. Take the plastic lid out and put it in a plastic bag next to you. You had to do that for 8 hours.
Yeah.
And, of course, what happened was they would do things like, if it got stuck, you couldn't use anything except a brass nail to remove the plastic lid, because the brass nail didn't scratch the mould, which was made of aluminium.
Right.
But these guys are so stupid, they'd use things like a comb or something like that and completely knacker the machines, because they'd leave the comb in there and then it'd close again and the comb would be part of the box.
Right.
I mean, they were just so thick.
Yeah.
So this guy said, I'll put you on top rate if you'll stay 6 weeks. I said, what? You know, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
I was getting paid more than Norman, my mate's dad, because he got thickhead rates and I got the top rate. I remember getting £8.50 a week and Norman was getting £6.50 a week.
Right.
Seriously.
I know.
Yeah, it was unbelievable.
But, I mean, we've been very fortunate in the sense that we've done jobs that we've really enjoyed, by and large.
Yeah.
I mean, most people that you talk to in the world, particularly people who don't get particularly well-paid jobs, they hate their jobs.
Well, do
they? They fucking hate the idea of work. Yeah, of course
they
do. Yeah.
Well, I don't think nurses hate their jobs.
Yeah, they do. How could you like doing that?
Well, I don't know. In fact...
Cleaning up after people?
Oh, fucking hell. I mean...
Dealing with sick people all the time?
When my poor old mum passed away last year, I went to see her a few times in hospital, and that used to occur to me. How young people... You know, can get any joy out of dealing with older people who have all sorts of problems. You
it's
know,
like the care business.
Yeah,
I mean, I passed
the
place the other day down in Sussex.
Yeah,
advertising for carers.
Yeah,
and I just thought to myself, that is one job I could never do.
Well, of course, Norman used to do it.
I mean, I don't even
want
to care for my own mother. Never
mind
fucking anybody else's.
Norman Luck used to do it. He bought a care home.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he made a fortune.
He bought it and sold it and all that. But mostly, what he did with the care homes was keep one bed vacant all the time.
So he could shag the nurses.
So he used to shag the matrons. He'd only appoint a matron if if she was pretty good looking, and B, she would agree to the old, you know, Norman Luck pork sausage on a regular basis,
indeed.
You know.
Yeah.
And
absolutely awful.
And you know, the question was always asked at Norman's care homes, why is that room at the bottom of the corridor always empty? You know, couldn't we bring another patient in? No, that's a special consultation
room.
Yeah, that's
absolutely
right.
Absolutely right.
Where Norman
get
his rocks off with the matron.
I'm afraid we're out of time.
That
was a fascinating,
fascinating
review of books, though.
Yep.
Thank you very much for that.
Certainly
we'll have another one same time next month.
Yes.
With the two mics.
Great. At his peak in the 1920s, he completely renovated a splendid Parisian mansion in which visitors ascended through halls of Rodin sculptures, Lalique glassware and Edward Burne-Jones paintings to his suite at the top. Yet he rarely slept there. He preferred to spend his evenings in another personal suite which he took at the Ritz Hotel. He could dine and bed the parade of young women.
Is this in London?
No, this is in Paris.
Oh, in Paris, right.
At the Ritz Hotel, he could dine and bed the parade of young women who were discreetly provided for his pleasure by the manager of the hotel.
Very nice.
Gulbenkian's inner life remains a mystery. During the Armenian massacre of the mid-1910s... Oh, I'm not interested in that.
why not?
Well, you know, nobody's ever heard of
being
it.
Being slaughtered.
Well, I know, it's unfortunate.
I think I've heard of the Armenian massacre.
Yeah.
I don't know why. Yeah, but you know what the problem was, though?
Yeah.
When you left, right, and I came back, and you went back to America, and I came back to London,
yeah,
and I started working as a reporter, they'd all been fucking cowed into complete and utter fear of going anywhere.
Right.
Because they all used to go down to the canteen.
Yeah.
And I remember the first couple of days I was there, and I'd noticed a couple of them sort of getting up, and Alex Hendry and fucking Fuller and all these guys, right? And I'm like, where you guys got to? Oh, we'll just go down to the canteen.
Yeah.
I'm like, you're joking.
Yeah, but they never went up the pub anyway. They were dullards.
No, but they were very... They were not keen on going. They've more or less been cowed into not going out at all because of you.
No, not because of me at all. Yes. They were dullards. And
in the same way that you banned smoking, apparently.
I did ban smoking, absolutely right. They were disgusting habits.
Yeah, well, I started again when I got there.
Yeah, I know, I heard that, yeah. You'd only appoint a matron if A, she was pretty good looking, and B, she would agree to the old, you know, Norman pork sausage on a regular basis,
indeed.
You know.
Yeah.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.